Mr. Goldsworthy Reelson.
The glow from the fires and the soft radiance of the sunset astern created a strange theatrical pink fog in which to port and starboard like a cavalcade of city traffic. The landing craft and tracked amphibians were sweeping towards the beach, file upon file, rank upon rank. Over our heads whirred the naval shells, and in return came mortar fire announcing themselves by dull thumps and water fountains. In this strange twilight, we moved in to watch the tracked vehicles clambering up the seawall, men leaping ashore and disappearing into the smoke. We turned and moved slowly past the seawall. In the haze, we saw four Americans busy at the water's edge. As we idled past only a few feet out, one of them spotted our boat. I don't know whether he was an officer, a sergeant, or a corporal, but he certainly didn't know that that boat contained Admiral Struble, commanding all the naval forces present, General Smith, commanding the Marines landing the assault, General Armand, who would command the army then streaming ashore, and General Lem Shepard, overall commander of the United States Marines in the Pacific. The man on the bank took a step forward and hollered, "Get the hell out of here with that goddamn boat! I'm gonna blow this wall!" One admiral, three generals, and six correspondents ducked for cover. As the boat turned briskly to seaward, and a great thump and a shower of debris falling astern showed us it was no idle threat, General Lem Shepard turned slowly round and drawled, "Well, goddammit, that's the first time I've ever been chased off a beach by my own men." That boat trip, by the way, gave me the chance to persuade Admiral Struble to transfer responsibility for clearing copy to the discretion of Captain J.C. Salter, commanding HMS Jamaica. He was as good as his word, and once his signal was received, I was really back in business. The last thing the North Koreans did before abandoning the port was to launch into the tideway a large number of floating mines, and with the tide running at times at 7 knots, they represented a constant threat to the bombarding ships. I counted seeing 10 exploded by small arms fire as the sea carried them through the fleet. They were still drifting past when darkness fell, but Jamaica stayed on station near her Year-Tis marker flag. When I turned in at 1:15, I knew the ship would go to repel aircraft stations as a precaution at first light. So when the loudspeakers brought the action station's pipe, I turned over to go to sleep again. Only seconds later, it seemed, the pom-poms opened up and I shot out of my bunk thinking that one of those mines was bearing down on the ship. Before I could drag on my trousers, the voice of the ship's chaplain, the Reverend Raymond Lowe, was announcing, calm as a cricket commentator, "We are being attacked by enemy aircraft. We have already shot one down." My self-chosen action station was a small platform just aft of the bridge where I could see all and bother nobody. When I got there, a patch of oil on the starboard side was the only evidence of the crashed aircraft. But on the port pom-pom, a boy gunner was dying. He had been wounded by one of the 18 cannon shells which left their marks along the length of the ship as two aircraft swept in on a low-level dawn attack. One cannon shell had exploded on my action station platform. I was grateful for my sleuth that morning. There just wouldn't have been room for all that cannon shell shrapnel and for me. It was while the bombardment was still going on that I chanced to comment to Padre Lowe that this being late September, I would be needing a warmer suit before the winter cold began to bite. "Why don't you get one made while you're up here?" he said. I looked at him in blank astonishment. "Where? There?" I asked, pointing to the smoking town. "No, no, in the ship," he said. "I'll show you." And up in the chain locker at the bows, He introduced me to a Chinese tailor and his two assistants, carried by long-established Far East Fleet tradition. The tailor was apologetic. The only cloth he left was rather expensive, he said. A suit would cost me £10, which even by 1950 standards was astonishingly cheap. So I was measured to the crash of 6-inch guns and my fittings while we were taking on more ammunition. And despite the tail end of a typhoon making the little workshop in the bows untenable for a day on the way back, was able to change from my marine battle dress into a smart blue civilian suit on arrival in Japan. From the ship, we could follow events with a sense of detachment and enjoy the exciting scene of sense of mission fulfilled when a cloud pillar on the horizon announced that one of Jamaica's salvos had found an ammunition dump which went up with such violence that the spotting pilot said it lifted his tail at 8,500 feet. But next day I saw the other side of the coin, the sickening misery that is part of every war. I got ashore into the captured town. Around the port and landing area, scores of buildings were still smoking. Nobody seemed to be doing anything about the fires. Where house walls stood, the interiors were a jumbled mass of fallen beams. Telegraph wires and overhead cables drooped across the shell-pitted street. Silent Korean families, heaven knows where they'd been the day before, stood in broken doorways watching the military trucks go surging up the hill out of the town towards the yet-to-be-taken capital, Seoul. Children were inventing new games among the rubble. Marines were giving food to a homeless little girl. Two old men wheeled the body of a young woman, partly wrapped in a sheet and somehow hunched up on a little bogey made only for firewood. Across the street, a woman and her daughter giggled as a young American Marine took their picture because they were the first Koreans he'd seen. On the balcony of a house with empty window frames and no doors, three Marines lounged on chairs above a doorway marked "The Scene, The Ritz." A group of women were cooking on the pavement a great steaming pan of rice and doling it out to their neighbors. At a landing jet, North Korean soldiers and South Korean civilians were lying side by side with American Marines awaiting attention on a landing craft fitted out as a floating medical aid station. South Korean flags were flying for the first time since North Korea and communist government forces had swarmed over the 38th parallel. Incheon had paid a high price for its liberation. That Saturday, Jamaica's guns were silent for the first time since the pre-landing bombardment 3 days earlier, and on Sunday we moved out to take on fresh stores and ammunition. We had left the immediate Incheon area and were at anchor with a store ship alongside when three jet fighters from an American carrier swept over the ship, and one of them circled and came down on the flat, calm sea, skimming across the surface like a skier. He had reported falling oil pressures and was ordered to ditch near the British cruiser. He did it so neatly that he clambered out of the cockpit and into the rubber dinghy without even getting his feet wet. At once the paymaster lieutenant went off in the whaler to pick him up. At the top of the rope ladder, he was met by Surgeon Commander Robarts, a much-loved doctor, whom everyone knew as Uncle Ropey. As the tall young pilot clambered over the railing, Uncle Ropey ran skilled hands over him and said, "Feel okay?" "Fine," said the pilot. "Then follow me," said Uncle Ropey, and led the way down to the wardroom, summoning a steward on the way. The bar was open. The steward produced a horse's neck, brandy and ginger ale, for the pilot, another for Commander Bilo, a third for Uncle Ropey, and a fourth for me. The bar closed again. The pilot's astonishment knew no bounds. Brought up in a navy where it's more difficult to get a bottle into a ship than a ship into a bottle, he will probably remember that mid-afternoon drink long after he's forgotten the details of ditching his plane. That same afternoon, the USS Missouri, America's biggest battleship, and generally known as the Mighty Mo, appeared on the horizon. A British frigate engaged on seaward anti-submarine sweep signaled to the Mighty Mo's leading destroyer, "Tell that cruiser to keep clear, I'm investigating suspected submarine contact." Came the crushing retort, "What cruiser?" This mild humiliation was soon revenged when the Mighty Mo flashed to Jamaica, "Have you a flag on board?" meaning, "Are you carrying an admiral?" Jamaica replied, "No." Mighty Mo signaled, "Then why are you flying that red flag?" Replied Jamaica, "Don't open fire, we're not Russians, we're only ammunitioning." Replied the Mighty Mo contritely, "Sorry, I couldn't see the smaller vessel alongside." It was during that bombardment that I suffered my only Korean War wound in the most ungallant fashion. I'd heard a tannoy call for me to report immediately to the bridge. In my haste, I slipped on an iron ladder and gashed the front of my leg against a step edge. The call was for me to speak on the radio to Lionel Crane, another Daily Express reporter. He'd turned up at an advanced observation post ashore, which was spotting for Jamaica. Lionel, who had been picture editor for a while, had chosen to get back on the road. My wound was not extensive, but it was deep. And in that humid Far East atmosphere, it turned septic and required treatment with penicillin, and I was advised to rest it as much as possible. When Jamaica reached Sasebo again, there was a cable from foreign editor Charles Foley saying, "Crane needs rest. Request you relieve him beachwards after fall Sewell. Confirm. Presume your finest hour seawards passed." Uncle Roper told me I shouldn't leave his care till the septic infection cleared, and I was tempted to report the delay due to wounded suffered during a bombardment. It would have been true, but I had the honesty to say I was being treated for a septic minor leg injury. Within a couple of days, I was flying the length of Japan to the Marinucci Hotel in Tokyo, base for most of the foreign correspondents covering the war. There I packed away my marine battle dress and bought a complete American outfit, including some very splendid infantry boots, the most comfortable I ever found. After just one day sampling the Tokyo flesh pot, I was airborne again, now in American uniform, for Kimpo Air Base near Seoul. At the foot of the aircraft steps, I walked into another Royal Navy story, a special raiding unit known as the British Volunteers. It was made up of 8 Royal Marines, a petty officer, a leading seaman, and 3 sailors, who had responded to a call for volunteers for special operations. After training with American Marines, they had become part of a raider force which went ashore to create a diversion before the main assault at Incheon. Then, working with South Korean Marines, they went from hilltop to hilltop, village to village, capturing, killing, or driving forward scattered North Korean groups. It was a remarkable demonstration of the adaptability of British sailor. I, too, had become adaptable, humping around with me not merely a typewriter, but sleeping bag and spare clothing. For a couple of weeks, my base was a patch in a correspondent's dormitory in an old barrack hut, and transport was the back seat of a jeep if I was lucky. More often, a perch on the back of a lorry loaded with stores. Sewell had just been taken, and the population was free to move, and for the first time were counting the cost in lives and misery of the communist occupation and departure. I say departure because, sprawled along the edges of a hastily dug defence ditch on the hills above Korea, I saw the mute evidence of the North Koreans' farewell to the southern capital. Stories of last-minute atrocities were circulating, and with the mayor of Seoul and other correspondents, I drove out of town and walked half a mile up into the sandy hills. Along the whole length of the defence ditch, in twos and threes, we found the bodies. We counted 27 trampled where the bullets had felled them, crumpled where the bullets had felled them. Most with their hands still tied behind their backs. None were war uniforms. 10 were women, and beside one lay the body of an infant. The trench went on endlessly, and there were more bodies, but we had seen enough.
Who had been responsible for it?
That was the retreating North Koreans, who were just taking vengeance on the people that they felt had been opposing them. Families were moving slowly along looking for their dead. A minor city official said his wife had been taken because she would not, or could not, tell where he was hiding. At least 100 people had been shot in that one police district, and the mayor estimated the number of the last-minute executions as being at least 1,000. We found a Korean professor, a graduate of an English university, who admitted that under pressure of threats to his family, he had translated propaganda leaflets to be dropped to American troops, promising them a lotus eater's paradise if they would stop fighting and surrender. He was ordered to broadcast nightly about 30 names of American killed. Because he was supplied with only 68 genuine names during August, he had to concoct 614 by taking Christian names from one page, surnames from another, rank from a third, and unit from a fourth. By contrast with the tales of brutality, I met 4 escaped American prisoners telling a tale with a difference. They were full of praise for their Korean guards. They'd been hiding for a week without food in the mountains after the remainder of their company had been wiped out. When they finally gave up, they were astonished how well they were treated. They were given food and cigarettes, and their 2 guards even spent their own money to buy and share apples. An officer captured in an ambush said, "Our guards were princes. They even went after other soldiers who had made the Americans exchange their boots for shoes and recovered and returned the boots." Every day and all day long, lines of prisoners and refugees lined the roads behind the forward areas. On one trip, we talked to an American colonel as we watched from a hilltop as his men cautiously entered a village in the valley. He said, "We want to make sure it is clear. Of course we could burn it down, but we'd rather not have to." There was something chilling in that considerate comment. One day, the jeep in which I was riding came under fire from an anti-tank gun. We bailed out and dived for cover behind a roadside cottage while the anti-tank shells screamed past a few feet away. I have a vivid memory of how one clipped a tree branch, causing it to keel over slowly and gracefully before falling to the ground. I can see it now. After half an hour of wondering whether a shell could actually come through the cottage, the firing stopped and we jumped back into the jeep, did a rapid U-turn and returned to safer areas. Once we went to visit a big prison cage. In the centre was a cinema. Its seats had been taken up to provide a dressing station, where once people had laughed at comedians, scores of men lie in silent robes, bearing pain with Eastern stoicism, their eyes following us as we walked through. In a side room, its windows open to the dust of tramping men outside. A doctor was working on one of many wounded brought in from the bitter cold of the mountain fighting. A nurse held an anesthetic mask over the patient's face. When I mumbled something about it being good that there could be some surgery available, she said with bitter frustration, "Surgery? My God, you call this surgery?" As we talked, there was the sound of something tinkling into a tin tray. And suddenly I realized what those tiny clatters were. They were gangrenous, frostbitten fingers being amputated. I felt as sick as I had done an hour before when a small boy had waved to me across the street with the blood-stained bandaged stump of an arm. Soon the word came round the press corps that after the success of the Incheon landing in cutting the North Korean links with their forces menacing Busan in the south, there was to be another bold move. There was to be an opportunity to take part in a parachute drop, and Sidney Smith, whom I regard rightly as the senior man on the spot, suggested I should go. Without any marked enthusiasm, I agreed. I've never yet turned down an assignment. But then another prospect dawned, a big-scale sea landing on the east coast at Wonsan, so Bill asked me to cover that, and he went on the parachute drop where he got a front page lead and two badly jarred ankles. Korea sticks down from the mass of Asia like a thumb. Incheon's on the west coast, Wonsan on the east. I was in one of 21 transports carrying troops for the assault in all 300 ships were to be involved. It should have been a three-day trip, but South Korean forces, at considerable risk of finding themselves cut off, had raced up the east coast and taken the airfield at Wonsan. Before they pulled out, the North Koreans had hastily dumped an estimated 3,000 moored Russian-type mines crowded into a few square miles off the Wonsan beaches. Helicopters spotted them so densely sown that 1,000-pound bombs were dropped among them in the vain hope of destroying whole groups by countermining chain reaction. Two American minesweepers were lost, then a Korean sweeper, and finally a chartered Japanese vessel, and still there was no safe channel. On our third day, when we were only 80 miles from the beaches and half a day from H hour, the whole convoy reversed course, and so it became known as Operation Yo-Yo. Scattered through the convoy, 30 newsmen fretted in a vacuum of radio silence, while 50,000 Marines engaged in the biggest operation of the whole war, steamed north by day and south by night. For 6 days and nights, we went up and down the Japanese sea before it was considered an acceptable risk to send the convoy in. The USS Bayfield, in which I travelled, was loaded with petrol, ammunition, and 2,000 men. On the 20-mile run up the channel, every man not needed below on duty was on deck wearing a life jacket. Most of us had our fingers crossed and heels raised against the possibility of one of those mines still being there. Traditionally, the Marines are the spearhead of the American forces, and in the eternal inter-service feud with the Army, they would leave on the landing beaches scribbled notices reading, "Welcome Army, it's safe now." At Wonsan, I found a torn-off Russian box lid reading, "Welcome Marines, it's safe now." To rub it in, the Army Air Force that afternoon flew in Bob Hope and a theatrical troupe to give a show in one of the airport hangars while the Marines were still bringing their equipment ashore. General Smith, commanding the Marines, told me, "Nothing much for you to stay for, we're just going to do some mopping up in the mountains." Next day, I flew to Tokyo, perched on a pile of mailbags in a military cargo plane. On the way, the radio was talking of MacArthur's hopes to get the boys home for Christmas. I dug deep into my kit bag, and from mouth to mouth we passed a whiskey bottle to toast the forecast, home for Christmas. But the days did not go, boys did not go home for Christmas. Many of my shipmates on Operation Yo-Yo died fighting their way back from the Chosin reservoirs when China sent her armies into the Korean conflict and prolonged it for several years. But by then, I had exchanged the humidity of the Korean plains for the glories of the Himalayas. When the submarine Truculent was lost in the Thames estuary after a collision with a merchant ship, the news of it broke suddenly with the calls from survivors being picked up and their messages being transmitted by radio. When the submarine Afray was lost in later on, there was no such dramatic denouement. It was just a growing anxiety over a silence which has never since been broken. The Afray was an old training submarine going out on exercises with five officers and 46 ratings and 20 young officers in training and four Royal Marines. Last message was that they were intended to dive some 30 miles or so south of the Isle of Wight, and then there was nothing at all. They should have been reporting their position the following morning, but the silence continued, and the Admiralty sent out first the sub-miss warning for shipping to look out, and then sub-smash, and brought all the possible rescue people into the area. But it was 60 days later before they actually located the submarine in deep water, about 260 feet deep, by ASDIC soundings. I was in the office when word came that they had had an almost certain identification, and I went off with a photographer down to Southampton, and we took a chartered ship out into the, not a ship, it was a ship, I suppose. It was more than a launch. We arrived on the scene and got aboard the salvage ship, and I was immediately rushed down into the wardroom by my old friend of Mediterranean days, Commander Lionel Buster Crabb, whose disappearance much later was an international sensation. He insisted on us having a drink, although I was protesting that we had very little time because we wanted to get back into the boat and get our pictures and get down to Guernsey and have them transmitted to London. And I didn't know till later that the reason for this